From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The world's meat habit has a bigger carbon footprint than our cars and trucks, yet humans want meat. Does it have to be real? Is there a more efficient way of creating that satisfying protein punch? A lot of people think so. There's a big push on this hour On Point, human craving, fake meat, and the health of the planet. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you open to the idea of fake meat? Could it be what's for dinner in your house? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New Orleans in Louisiana is Rowan Jacobson, author and journalist. His piece in Outside Magazine recently was headlined, "The Top Secret Food That Will Change the Way You Eat." Rowan Jacobson, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
We have a little tape of beef cows behind us right here, Rowan. The idea of fake meat or, I don't know, veggie burgers and all this talk about it, Bill Gates and all these billionaires getting in on it, can seem sort of overdone. What's the big deal about fake meat?
Yeah, I got interested when, as you said at the top of the hour, when I learned that the livestock industry is at least as big a contributor to climate change as all the cars and trucks on Earth, possibly two or three times larger. And then you get into all the other environmental issues that go along with livestock, from water use to the destruction of rainforests. And it just seems like, wow, in terms of fairly easy problem solving, getting away from that one could do a lot of good for without any huge technological challenges.
Give us a sense of the scale of that challenge to the environment. I have to say, for all that I've read about it over the years, when you sit down and really focus on people who are looking at short-circuiting that big, huge arc of beef and meat production, the numbers about the environmental cost of it are pretty stunning. I mean, you've got some reporting in here. Of course, it's what the cattle and everything else just drink, but there's also creating the food for them. California, you write, in the midst of one of the worst droughts ever recorded, shipping 100 billion gallons of prime water per year to Asia now in the form of alfalfa. Hey, so Japan and China can feed their cattle.
Exactly. And about a third of the Colorado River, which supplies water to pretty much all of Southern California, is used to grow alfalfa for our cattle. So you get rid of that industry, and California suddenly doesn't have any more water problems.
A third of the Colorado River, and it's not just water going in, of course, or the water that goes into the crops that feed all that livestock. It's what comes out of the livestock, other than cuts of meat, a whole lot of gas.
Whole lot of gas, yeah. And cows are just incredibly good at producing methane. It's kind of their killer app that they developed to be able to break down those really tough grasses that they eat. They use these bacteria in their stomachs that produce a ton of methane. And methane, it turns out, is 84 times as good as carbon dioxide at trapping heat. So about half of the global warming that we're experiencing right now is due to methane, not CO2. So more and more attention is being paid to methane as an equally deadly greenhouse gas.
So this really isn't just a culinary question. I mean, this is as much an environmental question as all the cars and trucks and ships at sea. And we know how big those are. And yet it collides, and you write very well about this, Rowan, with a very deep-seated human desire for that protein punch that meat delivers.
Right, and I love meat, and I've been a lifelong meat eater. And but you know, once I really started to look at the numbers, I kind of had to say to myself, you know, would I be willing to take one for the team and suck down some veggie burgers? And I kind of decided, yeah, I would.
But yet you say you want some. If you can't have meat, you say I want something damn close, a high performance, low commitment protein charge, good with Budweiser, good on the deck in the summertime, and all the rest. Are we just talking about veggie burgers here? I mean, those have been around forever. What's new here?
Right. Well, you know, I noticed at the top of the program, you used the terms veggie burgers and fake meat right next to each other. And that, to me, that's pretty interesting, because one thing I noticed when I was reporting on the story is people would ask me what I was working on, and I'd say fake meat. And, you know, you could almost just see the portcullis fall in front of their face. They were totally resistant to the idea. But then if I said veggie burger, people were like, oh, I love veggie burgers. So partly there's a terminology thing here. Partly what makes people uncomfortable is when we take these plant products and start really tweaking them on a pretty, you know, pretty basic molecular level to try to make them imitate meat. That gets people uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable because it seems like fake life or something. Like, I mean, this is muscle. We can relate to it. And I think a lot of people have in mind some of these experiments where they still are growing. I'm not even sure what you call it. It's sort of test tube meat. That's not what we're talking about here in the Bill Gates push and more.
Yeah, you know, I looked at that too. That's getting a lot of press attention, and I just think it's probably a non-starter. And in fact, it's making it a much harder job for the other companies that are just basically working with legumes and other plants and trying to create these products, because that vat-grown meat totally freaks people out. And I think there's pretty good reasons for that.
Gross. That sounds gross just on the face of it. This is where they're taking fetal serum and I don't know what all, and actually growing meat, but it's not attached to an animal.
Right, and they for some reason think that if it's technically a beef cell, that is going to make it more acceptable to people. But if anything, I think that puts it in that middle uncanny valley that people don't want to cross.
Sort of zombie meat. That's not what we're talking about here. You're talking about people taking vegetable protein and working with it to create something that is more and more meat-like, the vision of Bill Gates. And it turns out a bunch of other billionaires here, I guess because of what they see is the impact of this. Bill Gates saying steers, cattle, are a very inefficient way to produce this nutrition and experience for human. There's got to be a better way. So what's going on? What's the frontier of fake meat conception and production, Rowan?
The frontier is getting pretty – it's really pushing out there toward – I kind of feel like these first products that we've seen out there are kind of like the Model T. Like, you know, it's about as good as a horse, but maybe not that much better than a horse. But you can see where it goes from here. So right now, they've just started to figure out ways to make plant proteins chew like meat chews. Like a big part of the appeal of meat is that chew. The flavor is actually – pretty basic in something like a hamburger, but it's got that great release of fats and that slight chewiness that we like a lot. And they're really starting to figure out how to make plants do that for the first time. The earlier rounds of veggie products, or even if you want to talk about tofu, are never able to get that meaty texture to them. Now that's starting to change, and that's why Gates and a lot of these other venture capital people are getting pretty excited, because they see this as a huge problem that can really be tackled pretty quickly. And of course, they also see it as a huge business opportunity, because it's going to be pretty easy for these products to undercut the price of meat.
They don't do it yet. We'll talk with the founder of one of the really ambitious companies in this zone in a few minutes here. Of course, making it really satisfy that meat urge, not so easy. We heard on NPR the other day, Corby Cummer, he wrote about this for the MIT Technology Review, food writer, pays very close attention to the nuance of food. And he was talking about just how difficult it is to really be persuasive when it comes to fake meat. Corby Cummer.
Think about meat. It's got fat, it's got fiber, it's got gristle, it's got that delicious stuff by the bone, it's got brown bits on the outside. Think of trying to mock all of those up and glue them together. It's not easy.
Not easy, but if you could and persuade enough people to make the price point right, maybe humans could step back a bit from livestock production, which is, Rowan Jacobson and many others say, is imposing a huge cost on the planet right now. Rowan Jacobson joins us from New Orleans. He's been writing about this for Outside Magazine, writing very well, I should say. You can link to his articles at our website, onpointradio.org. Rowan, we've got callers from cattle country for you. Brad.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, watch out. Brad in Gainesville, Texas. Thank you for calling, Brad. You're on the air.
Thank you. The family has run a cattle farm for years, and now we're using rotational grazing, which is a greener way of raising cattle, because we're not buying hay, we're not buying alfalfa or anything mm-hmm. like that. We're mm-hmm. just rotating on our own land.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a greener way, and I'm not saying we could do enough of that to supply the world's demand of beef, but that is another alternative.
Brad, I grew up grazing livestock, and I know how satisfying that can be. And you know how much people have enjoyed beef for a long, long time. I guess with rotational grazing, you're just taking it right off pasture land, right off the or the range there. But what about the other environmental impacts? I mean, you can graze them any way you like, Brad, but still, they're going to have all that gas output. That methane is tough on the atmosphere, we're told.
That's true. But also, you know, you were talking about the environmental cost of bringing in feed and bringing in hay and all of that. We use very little fuel to, because we don't do any of that. We pick them up at the stockyard, we bring them to the farm, we raise them, and we take them back. I mean, we have two trips instead of constantly trucking in food and trucking in hay. So,
are you worried, Brad? You're a cattleman. Are you worried that fake meat is going to take your market away one day, or not worried about it?
Not worried. Honestly, I'm not worried because 100 years ago, the farm was spending more money to raise cattle. Now we're spending less because we're doing it smarter. Technology has allowed us to do that. So just like any system that's out there, you're either going to move on with technology and new systems, or you're going to die on the vine. So I believe if you're willing to change and use different methods that are more sustainable, you'll succeed.
Brad, I'm glad you are, and I'm glad you called. Rowan, just a second before the break here, disruptive technology coming to Brad's world?
No, I think people like Brad are going to be fine. It's more the factory farming techniques that I think are the low-hanging fruit we need to go for first.
Rowan Jacobson, writing for Outside Magazine, please stand by in New Orleans. This is very interesting territory. I have just had some fake meat delivered into the studio. We're going to have a taste of that. Think about whether or not it might supplant some significant portion of actual meat eating by humans. There's a huge climate and environmental impact of that. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the big push for fake meat to save the environment from the weight of industrial livestock production. It's getting a lot of attention. Bill Gates is out there on it. A lot of other tech billionaires, interestingly, looking over in this direction. It may sound like a small thing, like veggie burgers down at the corner market. But if enough humans switch from eating meat to eating fake meat made from vegetable product, people say it could have a huge, experts say it could have a huge impact on the climate, on the planet, our environment. Rowan Jacobson has written about it all for Outside Magazine. He joins us today from New Orleans. Here's a little sound of, we're going to hear in a moment from the founder and CEO of Beyond Meat. They're one of the companies looking to get that sort of mouthfeel and flavor and satisfying punch of meat into something not raised, not taken from livestock. Bill Gates has invested, so has Twitter, co-founder Biz Stone. Here he is talking in a kind of promotional video about why. Why is a Twitter co-founder getting into this fake meat?
Build systems that help people help each other to make the world a better place. What we're doing is partnering with companies and entrepreneurs who are making that their core, such as Beyond Meat. There are increasing studies showing us that due to the consumption of certain animal protein, heart disease increases by 21% and diabetes increases by 27%.
Not just the planet's health, but your health. We can't guarantee that guitars and xylophones will play when you eat fake meat. But it does seem to be getting a little closer to people finding it satisfying. Here's NBC News' Craig Melvin and Today anchors Matt Lauer and Tamron Hall and Carson Daly. They were taste testing Beyond Meat, the product, to see if they could tell the difference between real from plant and not. Looking at the fake chicken here.
Which one is real, Matt Lauer? Which one's fake?
This is real chicken. That's fake chicken.
This is real chicken.
That's real?
Real fake.
Yeah, real on the right.
All right.
Real on the
right. How about real is on the left?
No.
Oh, really?
Real is on the left.
Wow, Matt knew.
Chicken is on the right.
Interesting. There you go.
Matt knew. Who knew? Pretty soon, if you can't tell the difference, maybe it's not coming out of big industrial livestock farms. Rowan Jacobson, stand by in New Orleans if you'd be good enough. Gadon Eshel joins us right now from Annandale-on-Hudson in New York. He's a professor of climate physics and environmental policy at Bard College. Gadon Eshel, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You grew up on a dairy farm. You know this world well. Is this just a small thing to be thinking and talking about, or is it a big deal for the climate, for the environment, if we move people off livestock for their source of quote-unquote meat?
It is somewhat of a big deal. You know, the trouble with the climate challenge is that it affects all aspects of life. So there isn't one thing that you can go after, and if you nailed it, you nailed the problem. It is because of that ubiquity of the problem that the way we eat matters a great deal. It's responsible for maybe one-fifth of all the greenhouse gases that we emit.
So how, put some more, sorry to say it, but a flesh on the bones of that. How do you describe, this is your area of expertise, how do you describe the weight on the planet overall of meat production?
Oh, meat production in general, and but specifically beef. Beef is the big ticket item here. Those are incredibly inefficient pathways of producing something that people desire, meaning meat, out of available resources like sunshine, water, reactive nitrogen, and so forth. So it's basically comparing, let's say, a Hummer, in which case, you know, in
a Hummer,
case,
yeah.
A Hummer would be, beef would be comparable to a Hummer, and other foods will be more comparable to either, let's say, a Camry or even a Prius. Although the truth is that the difference between beef and other things far exceeds the difference between a Hummer and a Prius.
So if we could move it to a vegetable-based fake meat product on a very large scale, first of all, does that sound practical to you? And secondly, would it have a significant impact on the global environment?
About the practicality, I truly don't know. It's not my thing. You know, I mean, these guys are you know, very clever people working on making this happen, and more power to them if they can do it. That would presumably be great. I'm not an expert on this. Would it be important? Yes, absolutely. It will be incredibly important if people find it satisfying.
Rowan, why not just say, hey, everybody, let's be vegetarian?
Right. Well, the writer Tom Philpott has talked about waiting for the falafel revolution to take over, and he recently admitted that the falafel revolution just looks like it's not going to come. Like you said in the beginning, we love meat. Like, we love that sensation. So if we need to take these legumes and other products and give them a little bit more of that sensation to solve this issue, then why not?
Let's talk with the guy who's trying to do just that. With us right now from Los Angeles is Ethan Brown. He's founder and CEO of Beyond Meat. Based in L.A., producer of plant-based meat substitute. They make fake chicken strips and a kind of ground beef they call crumble and fake beef patties. He's got a lot of big investors there, including Bill Gates and others that we've mentioned here. Ethan Brown, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I've got a number of your fake meat products on the table here in the studio, fresh off the griddle. Give us some sense. Okay, I'm looking at a patty here. It looks like a patty that I might see in a quarter pounder at McDonald's, visually, something like that, when it's cooked. What goes into making this? How is this different from an old-fashioned veggie burger?
Right. So first of all, you paid me a big compliment by saying it looks like something from McDonald's. That, believe it or not, is a compliment.
Now, why is that? Let's just start right there. The color when it hits the frying pan that it takes on, you mean?
And in general, you know, our goal really is to provide a mainstream solution. So we're looking for products that can integrate into quick-serve restaurants like McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, et cetera.
I don't mean that as the highest gastronomic compliment to say it looks like a McDonald's burger, but I take your point. If you get there, you're into something that a lot of people eat with satisfaction.
Yeah. So Alton Brown is a friend and when the celebrity chef, and when he came to try the products, he made an interesting point that this may actually increase his consumption of steak, because what he'll do is for all the meals that he typically uses ground beef or other lesser cuts of beef, he would use our products. So he'd have more tacos, he'd have more bolognese, et cetera, et cetera. because they're basically neutral from a health impact. In fact, very helpful to him. Whereas steak, he knows, is negative, and so he only uses it sometimes.
So if I came to your plant to see how this patty was produced, what would I see you doing that would be different from an old-fashioned veggie burger I might have eaten years ago?
Right. So it's really interesting about meat, and I do tend to bristle when someone refers to our products as fake meat, although I certainly understand why. Is meat is really five things. It's amino acids, it's lipids, it's carbohydrates, it's minerals, and it's water. That's the composition of meat. Now, you can be hung up and say that, you know, meat has to come from a chicken, cow, or pig, but scientifically, if you think about what meat is, it's those five things. And so if we've taken those five things from the plant kingdom, which, by the way, they're absolutely abundant, and we've assembled them in the architecture of muscle, then I have a little bit of trouble saying, well, that's fake. It happens to be, in my view, an innovation on meat where it's taking those five constituent parts and putting them together, but from plants.
Oh, you're bold, Ethan. You're going to say, no, it is meat. But there is a kind of a traditional meaning of meat that it's, sorry, all you vegetarians, but it's cut out of an animal.
Correct. And so that's one, that's the origin of meat. But if you think about meat in terms of composition, it's scientifically, it's the five things that I mentioned.
Okay.
And if we're putting those five things together in the same architecture, at some point it becomes somewhat of semantics. But the more important thing is what we're doing is delivering the sensory and culinary experience of animal protein, but building it all out of plant protein. And that is the fundamental change. Whereas a veggie burger, I think it's something that tries to get a soybean or a lentil to provide some level of protein in a dish that may or may not be reminiscent of meat. But I think that misses largely what Rowan was saying, which is, listen, we've been consuming meat for over 2 million years.
Mm-hmm.
It's core to who we are, you know, the size of our brains, our upright stature. Everything about us can really be traced back to the decision to become more rather than less carnivorous. I think it's unrealistic to think that we're not going to consume meat. What I think is more realistic is that we're going to consume meat that is made directly from plants.
So take us into some of how that happens. Call it the magic, if you want, but with some nuance into, I mean, what do you start with? And how do you put it together in such a way that it begins to more closely approximate in a way that might satisfy that rather deep human craving?
So we're finding, what we do is we look for amino acids that we can then assemble or organize in the same structure that you'll find in animal muscle. And for us, it's taking, and this is somewhat of an approximation and explanation, but I think it's helpful. We're taking a set of disorganized proteins, and we're organizing them in the same fashion that the animal does in their muscle. And we're doing that in a very simple way. It's not Frankenfood. It's not, there's no artificial chemicals or anything of that nature. We're applying old-fashioned heating, cooling, and pressure. So if you've had pasta, you've had something that's been made in a similar process to what we're doing, we're just varying those rates in a much different way than you would if you're having, let's say, pasta or cereal or something like that that's also made in a similar process.
What's in here? Is soy the basis of it, Ethan, this patty in front of here with a couple of big bites out of it now?
If you're having the burger, mm-hmm. There's no soy in that. That's that's protein from yellow peas,
okay.
And those are and just to make the environmental point,
mm-hmm.
a pound of protein taken from yellow peas is 10 times more efficient from an emissions perspective than a pound taken from the most environmentally benign grass-fed beef operation.
Okay.
In terms of greenhouse gas emissions. So just that change alone, you can begin to see the impact that you might have on the environment.
Okay, keep going. I've got a bunch of yellow peas. How do I end up with a kind of tasty patty like this?
So what we've done is we've taken out basically the core protein. So we've done that through a separation process, which is aqueous. It uses water to separate the protein from the fiber and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then we run that through our system, which applies the heating, cooling, and pressure. That then aligns it in the muscular form that you see. Right. So that creates a stitching. It creates a striation that provides that very familiar feel on the mouth. And if you know, put aside all of the health, environment, animal welfare reasons for doing this, if you take a step back and say, okay, as humans, we communicate differently today, we transport ourselves differently today, our medicine is different today, the one thing it really hasn't changed about is the fact that we consume meat off the bone of an animal. But there's a massive bottleneck in a classic operation sense, and that bottleneck is the animal. We've dramatically increased the efficiency of the field, but we have not increased that much the efficiency of the animal. There's only so much you can do to increase the efficiency of the animal. There's only so much more room left to do that. And so what we've done is say, well, don't use the animal at all. Let's fix this classic production bottleneck by simply eliminating the need for the animal and creating that protein directly from plants.
We're talking about, well, I have to say, Ethan's protest notwithstanding, in a way, fake meat. Maybe one day people will just think of it as meat, but not from animals. Princeton in Lexington, Kentucky. Thank you for calling, Princeton. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to say there's no way in the world you're going to produce fake meat and it'd be something that people want to get. It's not about the minerals in it. It's not about the protein in it. Meat is just good. Like, I'm right now in the store with my wife, Diane, and we're buying meat. You know, you can't plant-based it. Diane, get the bigger steak, the bigger one. we have to, you know, it's the smell, it's the flavor. Nobody ever says, hey, you want to come to my house, come over to my house and get this zucchini meat? No, I want steak.
Hey, but listen, Princeton, I hear you, and you're out shopping right now and telling Diane to get the bigger steak. Okay, but what if Ethan and his buddies or other companies working on this can begin to figure out how to make something that actually does have some of the texture and aroma and mouthfeel and satisfaction of meat? Would you eat it, Princeton?
Well, the thing about it is I'm an American and I'm not stupid. Like, we know that it doesn't come from an animal, and we're not on that. You know, we're hardworking, diligent people. We want the real deal. Nothing can replace that. It's like, you know, your mom making you a steak when you were a kid or seeing your dad eat it. It's got to be the original. We're not going to take anything less.
Princeton, I appreciate your call. Good luck with your shopping there. And my best to Diane. Ethan Brown, there's your challenge. What do you say to the Princetons of the world?
First of all, I absolutely loved it. I mean, I think that's a very clear expression of a very strong opinion. And you know, what I would challenge is that I'm not sure of the gentleman's age, but, you know, the phone that his parents used when he was a kid, right, is probably very different from the one that he and his wife have in their pockets they shop. And they most likely have something like an iPhone. So we no longer go around using the landline, right? And there's countless examples of that. And I think the one that really resonates with me is the automobile. And Henry Ford once said, you know, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have said they wanted faster horses. You have to be able to present to people like that caller something that is so real, that is so convincing. They say, well, of course, why wouldn't I do this? I want to be around to see my grandkids. I want to help the planet. I want to do all the positive things that switching those 3 or 4 ounces to the center of the plate allow me to do. So I think it's on us. It's our obligation to create products that are so great that it moves it from an obligation. And that's why I'm not a big fan of the Meatless Monday campaign. I really view this as something that you have to make the product so desirable, so good, so obvious in its choice that people want to use it every day.
Rowan Jacobson, you're listening. Speak to Princeton there. You've eaten a bunch of this, Rowan, and you're the guy who likes to have it, you know, on the deck with the Budweiser. Is it convincing to you? Is it persuasive as a substitute?
Well, I think the important thing is to think about what it's going up against. Not Princeton steak, which, you know, I hear where he's coming from totally. But I would ask him to you know, swing by his favorite fast food restaurant of choice, order a burger, pull out that patty from that burger, and eat it on its own, and tell me that there's something magical there that he really wants to defend.
Not. If you slipped one of these in, would you know the difference? Would it be better?
I think it would be equally good, if not better. I've done that, and I was very satisfied. So it's really, you know, when a hamburger is a lot of things coming together. And actually, I meant to ask you that, Tom. Are you eating that sucker straight up, or are you eating it in classic burger form?
I'm sorry to say I'm eating it straight up, like your patty slipped out of the burger at the fast food shop. So no, it's not adorned with ketchup and pickles and lettuce and all the rest. But I can taste exactly what's in here this way.
Yeah, it's true.
What, are you suggesting I need to slather on some ketchup and mustard and relish or something here?
Well, yeah, I'm saying that the chicken McNugget and the classic, you know, fast food hamburger patty, nobody is going to miss them that much if they get replaced. And a whole lot of good can be done simply by doing that. And, you know, we can put the steak off for way down the road.
Princeton, you might not know the difference. Scott and Eshel, are you getting excited at the prospect of this possibly coming on stream here? Maybe your environment will get fixed.
Maybe.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big push for fake meat to save the environment from the weight of industrial livestock production. Meat production globally, bigger carbon footprint than all the transportation on the planet. Cars and trucks and ships at sea, that's a lot. This sounds like maybe a small thing, like a veggie burger. It's more than that. They're trying to make it very persuasive, and there are some big bets here that it could substantially change our relationship with our environment, which could use some relief. Gadon Eshel is with us this hour from Bard College. He's a professor of climate physics and environmental policy. Rowan Jacobson has been writing about all this. Great articles in Outside Magazine. Will the Beast Burger put beef out of business? The headline. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. He's with us from New Orleans. And from Los Angeles, Ethan Brown is here. He's founder and CEO of Beyond Meat, an L.A. company, producer of plant-based meat substitutes. They make fake chicken strips, or call them what you will, sort of crumble, hamburger type stuff, beef patty type of food that's on the table right in front of me here. And I have to say, I keep nibbling more little pieces off of it because it's pretty darn good. Calls for all of you. Courtney in Waitsfield, Vermont, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring out a point. I've been a vegetarian for about a year now, and I do not choose to eat fake meat for the most part, maybe once in a while, because I feel like highly processed products, whether they're meat or fake meat, are still not good to put into your body on a regular basis. You know, it's been proven that the more the things are processed, the less healthy it is, that a plant-based whole foods diet is the way that we need to start moving. And even as far as the fake meat goes, have they looked at what the carbon footprint would be if this was scaled up to something like McDonald's size, as far as plastic, packaging, the factories that would be needed? So I just don't see how this is really a solution to the meat problem. I think Americans need to change their mindset and view meat as perhaps a condiment for flavor and not as, you know, something to be the majority of your portion. So that's just my point. Thank you.
Courtney, we'll take it all up, and I appreciate your call. Ethan Brown, the processed food complaint here from our vegetarian Courtney. And let's say that it takes off and you've got the packaging and all the rest. What about the net impact of your products?
Sure. So great question, and it's a common observation. So it's not, I think, correct to refer to our product as something that's more processed than meat. So if you think about it, it's really a tale of two processes, and it's which one you want to be involved in.
I got to stop you right there because Courtney's not on board with that. She's a vegetarian, and she's saying treat meat as a condiment. Get it out of the – she wants to compare this to whole foods, just like, I guess, picking up lentils or yellow peas at,
sure,
you know, right from the farmer's market.
I'd love to have her come to my house because I have kids who are 9 and 10. And after the softball game, the baseball game, the basketball game, mm-hmm, the meal of choice is not lentils and kale. It's for their team. It's Domino's and McDonald's.
Bad daddy.
Not maybe, me. I'm saying for the team, right?
Yeah, so, okay. But maybe I mean, maybe Courtney would bring them kale chips and say, "Enjoy, kids."
That'd be great. And I think if we could get the rest of the country to eat like that, that would be fantastic. I think that the challenge is that we are very accustomed to consuming meat, and as we've noted before, you know, this is something we've been doing over a very long period of time. It's so central to who we are. So I don't think that you're going to find much success in a movement that suggests we don't continue to eat meat. I think what we need to do, is, as I said earlier, is look at plant meat. And I think if you think about it, it's really not, is this a processed food in a way that's any more processed than meat? It's actually, in fact, less processed than the industrial meat that people are consuming. We've offered to have people come at any time to our facility to see exactly how it's made. We've asked Tyson and Purdue and others to make the same offer. Of course, they can't. But our process is a very simple one.
They can't because it's too gross. You mean people don't want to see it?
I just in the regulations and everything else. But you can come anytime without notice to our facility, and we'll give you a tour. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something we believe very strongly that people should understand how their food is made. They should see how it's made, and we have nothing to hide. And I think that's something that's very different. You know, there's no sort of, in the plant-based meat world, there's no lobbying for gag laws, right?
Still, you've got the processed food worry here. People have, you know, everybody knows now the formulation. You want the fewest ingredients possible in whatever you're putting into yourself. And Courtney's applying that here. You've got a lot of ingredients in here to get this flavor and this texture.
Right. And so what I think the key is, though, we're instead of taking it through the processing of an animal, which is fed antibiotics, which is often given hormones, has a very specialized food that's fed to it, has lighting and everything else that's mm-hmm. controlled and climate controlled in the facility. We are taking protein just directly from the plant and applying heating, cooling, and pressure. It's difficult to say that is actually something that's more processed than industrial animals.
Courtney wonders what would happen if some of the big food distributors would pick you up and begin to use you. Tyson, for example, or McDonald's. First of all, has McDonald's come to you? Or might they have a yellow pea burger, other kind of meat burger on the menu one day?
So we are in a discussion with one of the major quick serve restaurants, but we're not at liberty to disclose it. But in terms of the environmental impact, I think it gets back to you know, what is the carbon footprint of our core proteins? And if you look at the yellow pea example I gave, where it's 10 times more efficient from a greenhouse gas emission perspective, you begin to see, I think, on water, we're about 6 times more efficient from the actual starting protein point. In terms of packaging and everything else, we don't, you know, we package pretty much just like you would animal protein. So I think that would be kind of a neutral impact.
So our Courtney and our listeners, they're a tough audience. You know, that's not what they want to compare to, because they're not happy with that amount of packaging and plastic and that comes off of food. You don't escape that. You want to put yourself right up against packaged meat at the supermarket counter.
I am, if anything, pragmatic. I mean, I think you have to make these small changes. You have to be willing to work within the system. I don't see a world where kids go from chicken McNuggets to kale overnight. I just don't see that. I mean, in fact, I don't think our biology is set up to do that. We began eating meat because we wanted the nutrient-dense food, right? And so it was something that, you know, we saw chimpanzees consuming, they chew 12 hours a day. I just don't think that we're so conditioned now to seek out that nutrient-dense food. And what we did with the Beast Burger, who said, let's go ahead and, from an evolutionary perspective, continue along that trend. Let's provide consumers with something that's more nutrient-dense than meat. So that's why you see the antioxidants, the omegas, you see all the vitamins that we're able to blend into that product to make it something that is more nutrient-dense than animal protein.
Courtney, we report, you decide. Colin in Spencer, Ohio. Colin, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
My comment would be, I'm completely on board with the amount of greenhouse gases emissions that you have and the carbon footprint left behind with factory farming.
Okay.
But your guests actually made a comment on grass-fed beef. And I would say that from a carbon sequestration standpoint and from a total carbon footprint, what he's saying about producing a crop, an annual agricultural crop that you have to actually go out with fossil fuels, harvest this crop,
yep,
process this crop, there's absolutely no research on the ground that would state that he would actually be less of a carbon footprint than grass-fed organic meats.
So you're saying when he goes out to get his yellow peas and whatever else goes in to the Beyond Meat product, he can't make the case that that's a lower ultimate footprint than beef production?
Unless he's doing it 100% with hand labor, it's completely impossible to make that statement. For example, with ethanol production, it takes 3 gallons of fuel, right, for every gallon of ethanol produced. So it's completely unsustainable. People like, there's a biologist named Alan Savory who has done 30 years of research on grass-fed organics, and he has used intensive rotational grazing in highly degraded arid landscapes like Africa, places in South America, where he's using highly intense grazing patterns to completely restore completely degraded desertified land.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's absolutely no research on the ground that shows that annual agriculture has any positive effect on the environment. There's nowhere in nature where annual agriculture exists independently, but there's everywhere in nature, savannas, all over the entire world, where you see huge herds of animals moving from place to place,
right,
eating, processing the plant materials,
yep,
putting down their manure, and then by doing so, creating a humus layer in the soil, which sequesters carbon, filters water, and holds water into the ground, and then also restores the natural plant system. That's happened for millions of years.
Colin, we've got it. That's an interesting point. Of course, you're not talking there about huge feedlots in Colorado full of beef cattle, but it's an interesting point. Let's go to our professor, Gedeon Eshel, as you listen to that. You're our professor of climate physics and environmental policy. What about the point Colin's making there?
They are well-presented, and they sound seductive. They only suffer from one problem, and that is that not one of the arguments being made is numerically true. Let's start with this. What Ethan is using for his
base material,
beyond meat, is unquestionably more environmentally sound than anything it replaces. If the caller said there's no research on the ground or something like that, well, there is. You should read the right journals, and you will see that there are many, many hundreds, actually probably thousands, of papers that show just that. There's no question that the raw sources of protein that they use are far superior to anything that they replace. That's number one. Number two, and that is something that actually the caller and Ethan both aired on, and that is to suggest that grass feeding is somehow superior to trough feeding, to industrial. In fact, industrial production of beef, and of all animals really, is slightly more efficient than the same production, if it's possible to do it, the same production on grass. So that is definitely not true. The sequestration point that was raised.
Mm-hmm.
At most, the most refractory elements of soil organic carbon have a time scale of about 100 years. In about a century, they go right back to the atmosphere as gaseous CO2, radiatively active again. Now, the time scale of the global warming problem is at the very least many millennia. So the fact that we put a little bit of added carbon into the soil with a time scale of a century relative to the time scale of the problem, which is many millennia, is entirely irrelevant. Even if they were right, which I gravely doubt, because many papers that have tried to substantiate those claims quantitatively failed to. But let's even say that they are right. It doesn't matter. The timescales simply don't work.
It's upon us.
I'm sorry?
The problem is upon us now, or coming.
Well, and it's going to linger for thousands of years. That's what matters. So if you put it away for a little bit, it makes almost no difference whatsoever. Now, on top of that, the last point, the savory thing, I don't want to discuss that because that has been debunked so many times that it's really time to give it a break. But suppose you even say, okay, I see cows grazing and I see nothing happening except sunshine being fixed into sugars and the cows turning it into protein. What's not to like? Well, yes, in that bucolic scene, there's nothing to not like. But what do you do? I mean, suppose you're in Wyoming and you're grazing that cow. How long would that last? Well, about 3.5 months. What do you do for the rest of the year? Feed the cow and her calf exactly the same food that you will feed any other cow.
Forgive me, Professor Eshel. I want to get one more call. Jacob at home in Louisiana. Jacob, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I was really concerned about the cost of the meat, because the health foods really seem to be much more expensive than anything else you can get. You can go to Taco Bell and get a thing full of beef for like $2.
Yeah. So, let us pick it up. Our time is short. Ethan Brown, very broadly, I'm looking here at some comparison. It looks to me like your product is about twice the cost of real meat. Am I about right, and does it have to be that expensive?
First, let me just address the point from Cadone. I agree 100% about grass-fed beef. We pick that because the meat industry uses that as the example. We said, okay, give us your perspective on this, and then we did our comparison against that. But I agree with that debate, and that is not as efficient as people claim. But on the question of cost, there is no material obstacle to us getting well below the cost of meat. And again, it gets back to basic operations textbook. If you look and see where's the bottleneck in production, we've removed it, and you can start to see as we get scale that we can underprice meat. We're not there today just because we're operating at a very, very small scale. We are not twice the price, though. If you look at, let's say, something that's comparable to our product, a cooked chicken strip in the retail sector sold by Tyson or Purdue, for example, we're often price competitive with that today. Where we're not is when you look at some of the raw chicken breasts and things of that nature. We have room to go there for sure.
Rowan Jacobson, our time begins to grow short here. You're, in a sense, our smart layman here who likes meat and has tasted a bunch of this, and you see the problem. What do you think? Could we go this way? Could we tilt away from, depending on livestock, for this, and bring on the yellow peas?
It's going to happen. Talk to the 20-year-olds out there. There's very little resistance from them.
You think if we come back here in, 10 or 20 years, this could be a significant portion of what we think of as meat on the plate?
I think 20 years from now, it'll be huge. And the products we're talking about today are just the tip of the iceberg. You're going to see stuff coming out in the next couple of years that'll be a whole nother leap forward.
Well, watch this space. Interestingly, I'm still tempted to take another bite of this patty. That says something right there. Rowan Jacobson with Outside Magazine, thank you so much for being with us from New Orleans.
Thanks, Tom.
Gadon Eshel at Bard College, thank you, sir, for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And Ethan Brown with Beyond Meat in L.A. Thank you, Ethan. Good luck.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.